Well, Jim, thank you very much for agreeing to be in the Practical Broker podcast today. I really, really appreciate you taking the opportunity to come join us.
Not a problem.
I've known you for a number of years, and we met, I'm guessing now it's probably going on close to 10 years, and in the collaborative law practice, which when I found it, I was really intrigued that there was divorce a different way.
Yes.
I think that's where we first came into town, or got to know each other.
Right.
And you started your career, I guess you went to McGill, and then you went to Ottawa U.
Right.
You've had different careers. You started, worked your way up in different law firms to become a partner at Lowe Murchison, which is Lowe Murchison Randolph.
Yes, let's give them the due there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And what was that journey like? How did you decide to get into law? And in particular, how did you decide to get into family law?
Well, you know, sometimes these things pick you, right? Yeah. So I was working in a small rural office. And, you know, that's largely what came in the door, right? I was doing, you know, whatever came in, right?
Right.
And most of it was family law. And I guess I found it was a niche that worked for me. But I was a general practitioner for many years. Then when I moved into town, I guess I already had a bit of a reputation around doing, family. But I did other stuff as well. And I kept doing that, and I still do, in fact, do other areas. But family's been the bulk of my work, and particularly my interest, right, in the sense that I got involved in about 2002 in the collaborative scene. And, of course, since then, I've become very active in that community and currently as president of the Ontario Association of Collaborative Professionals. But worked in the auto area for many years, and also with the board, still member of the board. So,
perfect. So you helped grow the auto collaborative group, and then you've moved up now into the provincial venture.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I was a founding member of the Collaborative Practice Ottawa, what we used to call the Ontario Collaborative Law Federation. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that was the provincial group. The we were called the Collaborative Law Network. That's our legal name.
Right.
And so, I was part of that. I was treasurer for many years. Then I was president, past president, and now just a board member. And through that, of course, moved into the provincial area and have been on the provincial board for 4 years, I guess, now. And
that's amazing.
President for the last year and a half.
That's great. Yeah, we're going to do a deep dive into collaborative practice a little bit later show, which I think is one of those best-kept secrets, I think, in the family law world.
100%.
But before we get into that, tell me about, because it's something that I've always been curious about, is the journey to partnership for a lawyer. How does that happen? Because we hear all this time, partners and lawyers and your partner. And like, what does that mean?
Well, partner means that you've got some skin in the game, right?
Okay.
So I have an ownership interest in the business.
Yeah.
And lawyers are more restricted in terms of what their business structures are that are available to them.
Okay.
So it used to be that many firms were some kind of partnership. They vary in different different ways.
Yeah.
So if often it was sole practitioners,
right.
Or small firms, and then much larger firms. And I'm going to say probably in the last 10 or 12 years, I guess it's been we've been permitted to incorporate ourselves, but again, more limited than standard other businesses.
Yeah.
But getting into the partnership really is just about, are you interested in having interest in the...
Being an entrepreneur?
In the bottom line, right?
Yeah.
So we, at our office, we have associates who are employees. Mm-hmm. We have what we call non-equity partners, so people who are basically sharing expenses with
us.
Yeah. And then partners. And partners are the owners of the business. And so I'm one of those. And I've been doing that since 2009. I was a partner in a firm previously as well. That was a smaller office.
Right.
So it's just about putting your money where your mouth is.
Right? Absolutely. So Lowe Murchison Randolph, you guys handle a whole slew of things.
Right. Yeah. We're a general practice firm. Yeah. The only things we don't do are immigration, criminal, and recently intellectual property, but pretty much everything else you need, got people who can do that for you. So,
and you're specialized really in family and estate law, I believe.
That's right. Yeah. I do some corporate just as a connected to those things typically. And I have some some corporate clients that I've had since I was, you know, since I started out.
Right.
You know, that, you know, you, and people, connections that I have.
Yeah.
And I you know, I work with them, and I work with an international non-government organization as well.
Oh, that's awesome. That, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of the things I like about doing these podcasts is I get to find out some really cool stuff about people, and then even people I've known for years, and you're like, wow, that's really neat.
We don't talk about everything every time, right?
It's
so
true.
There we go. But yeah, so it's, no, it's great. You know, family law is an area that introduces you to all kinds of different things, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, we have entrepreneurs. We have people who are, you know, who are employees. We have people who are government, you know, yeah. people. We have people who are, you know, in government. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, so I love the fact that, you know, when somebody says to me, hey, do you have a plumber or do you have a mechanic? Yes, absolutely. Let me call him for you. Let me give you a number, you know?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, yeah. So that's great. It has allowed me to build a very, you know, expansive network.
For sure.
And so, yeah. Keep those connections up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So. That's fantastic, Jim. It's amazing. That's one of the similarities of our business, and that I enjoy is hearing about all my clients, the unusual employment situations, or entrepreneurs going into some manufacturing facilities. And because I'm an entrepreneur at heart, I love finding out about all these neat things. And,
well, you know, I think it's really important when you're representing a business mm-hmm. that you spend some time to actually get to know the business, right?
100%.
You know, if you can get to the location, you know, if you can spend some time learning about what they're doing, you know, that's, it may not be so important for the specific, you know, problem or issue that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
But I love to have that, you know, that ability to sort of connect on a Absolutely. Different level with people.
Well, that's something I've found about you over the years, and where we have a similarity is we take a holistic approach to our clients.
Yep.
Sometimes people come to us for this little narrow problem, and because we've been doing our jobs for so long, we see the bigger picture. I'm like, okay, but maybe we can steer them around, and there's a totally different solution that they're not even thinking of. It solves multiple things.
Yeah, well, and it brings us back, you know, to the thing you were saying about collaborative, right? Which, mm-hmm. you know, where they're, you know, a process like that,
yeah.
you know, that's consensual, that's, you know, client-centered, right, allows much wider options for resolution than, you know, the 100%. Standard court process, for example, right?
For sure.
Yeah, so that's why I think one of the things that draws me to it, right?
Mm-hmm. So I see quite often in our finance practice that young couples are coming to us to get a mortgage. They're buying their first house. They're all starry-eyed, and, you know, they're in love forever. And unfortunately, as you know, the statistics aren't necessarily in their favor. And so gently, I try to, you know, bring up the concept of a cohabitation agreement. In particular, it usually tends to be, you know, I don't know why the stats on my business are this way, but the lady of the relationship tends to have a great job, saved up a ton of down payment, and then there's a gentleman that comes along and has, you know, maybe bad credit or no job. And so I see, in particular, this has happened many, many times in my practice where the lady's putting in hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then several years later, they end up splitting up, and then that person loses all that down payment.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
So it's not, you know, I appreciate that you're seeing this mm-hmm. often in the context you're referring to. Mm-hmm. But of course, it goes both ways.
It does.
You know, and it can
100%.
Be same-sex couples as well, right? That, yeah. you know, that you have these kinds of experiences. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that if you're getting into a relationship and you're not really starting out from the same place, whatever that is, right, it's really a good idea to talk to somebody about whether or not mm-hmm. you want to have an agreement. And it's not just married couples either. It's unmarried couples
right.
as well, right, because there are obligations. They're just not as clear cut, shall right. we say, with the unmarried spouses. So I really, you know, I would encourage people to think about cohabitation agreements mm-hmm. or marriage contracts. I just recently did an article on that, actually, you know, just saying, hey, you know, let's get some of these myths about right. cohabitation or marriage contracts out of the way, because they really are a good thing.
Yeah. What are
from
some
my
of those
perspective.
Myths?
Say it again.
What are some of those myths that?
Well, I mean, for example, yeah. you know, if you're asking me to do this, you don't love me. Mm. Well, you know,
right.
of course. In fact, I would say the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, one of the biggest things that people fight about is finances.
Right.
Right. And particularly if you're coming at it with you know, with varying degrees of capacity, if I can call it that, right?
Yeah.
Financial capacity, right? You know, we're just having one right now. I've got a client who's the son of a very successful businessman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dad has allowed his children to participate in the business. They do very mm-hmm. well, thank you very much. But everything is owned by dad. Dad mm-hmm. is getting to that point where it's time to think about, you know, what am I doing next?
Right.
And so what's that succession look like? And dad's saying, you know what? I'm not doing this. I'm not giving you these shares unless, you know, you have something in place that protects me from being, you know, having your partner come after me or come looking to me for my business,
right,
you know, to get paid out because, yeah, you know,
or sit at the table.
Right. Right. And of course, you know, the thing that people don't understand is that separation occurs in every situation,
mm-hmm,
because separation also occurs on death.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's not just voluntary.
Right.
Right. And so there's always going to be a separation in a relationship, right, of one sort or another. And so we have to think about that. Right. And so, so we're just, you know, we're having a discussion right now between the, you know, the wife, the new, yeah, wife, and this young fellow who's saying, I'd like to be able to get, you know,
yeah,
some interest in this business, yeah, you know, and dad's saying, not unless you have something in place. Thanks very much. Yeah. You know,
unless you earn in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs come along, and I'm sure there's a thousand ways to structure things. Was almost creating a line in the sand and saying, here's what my assets are today. Things we grow together, honey. We'll share, but this historical money, this money coming from my dad or my mom, is it's compartmentalized.
Yeah.
So they can share in the, in growing together as a couple, but still protecting those assets. Like,
yeah, that's often, and in fact, the law recognizes that if you're married, mm-hmm, right, in that, you know, you get a deduction, or we, you know, for what you bring in.
Okay.
So if you start a relationship and you're married,
yeah,
and you then separate,
yeah,
and we're talking about, okay, so what are we dividing? We're dividing what you acquired during the course of the marriage.
Right.
There are exceptions, and there are fairly major exceptions, so nobody, yeah, should just take what I'm saying just, you know, yeah, off the cuff. It's really something you need to talk, yeah, to somebody about. But the, for reality, sure, is that the law recognizes that for married couples.
Right.
Much different situation for unmarried couples, yeah, you know, where it isn't so straightforward.
And how does, I know we briefly touched on, and then our lunch we had the other day where we talked a lot about same-sex couples,
mm-hmm,
and the unique challenges that those kind of agreements create.
Yeah, yeah. And so again, you know, on my website, yeah, so in our blog, I did a little paper about, mm-hmm, you know, dealing with same-sex couples and the kinds of situations that arise in those that are, you know, maybe a little different, yeah, than what you'd see in a, yeah, you know, in a mixed
marriage. And what's one of the common, most common,
you know,
situations?
So I think, I'm trying to think of an example. Oh, well, so we just, you know, just had one. Now it wasn't property. It was, you know, kids. It was,
yeah, spousal. Yeah.
But we had, you know, a same-sex couple who had, yeah, children. One of the parents was inseminated.
Okay. Yeah.
The other was, you know, was not a genetic parent.
Right. Okay.
And of course, there's some recent case law about that. But
interesting.
Know, the question, of course, is, you know, okay, so who's the parent?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Who's not a parent? Right. What are the obligations?
Yeah.
Right. Do we, and we, when we separate, you know, do we continue to have relationships with these children that we used, the same way we used to have them? So we get into, you know, those kinds of,
right,
those kinds of questions. As I say, there's, you know, the law is developing on that, yeah, but
it hasn't caught up yet to the reality of where
that's
we're living.
For sure. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So there's a great idea is that having that, those conversations, although they're hard to have at the beginning, because everybody doesn't think bad things can happen, but you know, you want to, if you want to have children, or I'm in that case where my spouse, Murillo, brought in two kids from a previous relationship, and I've raised them.
Yeah.
So something should happen, even though they're not biologically my kids. They've been.
So that's a, you know, that's a real area for,
mm-hmm,
potential problem, right?
Right?
Where you know, you want to be a decent guy or a decent, you know, woman who's looking after the kids of your partner, right? But the law imposes obligations on you that maybe you didn't intend,
mm-hmm,
right? So you get in there, you spend a few years, you're a nice person, you know, you support the kids, you buy them gifts, you know, they start to call you dad,
mm-hmm,
right? And then you separate and you say, well, okay, see you later. And there's, wait a second. Nope. Hold on.
Yeah.
You have now, you know, created this dependency. You can't just say, thanks very much. See you later. I'm not doing this.
Right.
To say nothing about the emotional connection.
Right.
And so, you know, what do you do to the kid who's now developed this relationship of some significance, right?
100%.
So, yeah, so definitely worth talking about, yeah, how are we managing this going forward in the event of a separation, yeah, when, like I said.
And even like you said, you know, unfortunately, it's scary to talk about in law sometimes, but even in death where, you know, okay, if one spouse, like in my case, if mom's gone and we didn't have proper paperwork in place, well, you know, if they're minors, who's looking after them?
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely the guardianship issue.
Yeah.
Certainly something that can be discussed in a cohabitation agreement or, you know, oft, of course, we'll do it in separation agreements. And and as well, we'll do it in estates, you know, in estates planning, right? Yeah. We'll be doing succession planning. We'll be talking about
for sure
who's looking after the kids if, you know, you can't.
Yeah. Right? The important thing is talk to a professional, right? Get the really good advice 100%. And don't be scared.
Yeah, exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, and, you know, you and I, when we were talking about this, I was mentioning to you that, you know, one of the nice things for me about doing non-adversarial kind of work is mm-hmm. that we can have that conversation without it turning into, you know, a conflict, which it often does in a sort of a typical
more traditional
situation. Area. Right. Yeah. So it's, you know, my opinion is have the conversation, then think about what the result is going to be. Don't have the result and then.
Right.
Right. And people do that all the time.
Yeah.
Right. It's just a recipe for difficulty. Right.
Well, that's a good segue into conflict. And, you know, spouses I've seen occasionally in my practice is in the mortgage world where spouses won't leave the house. What happens in that situation? It's a common question I get.
Yeah, I know.
I had it last week.
It's complicated, right? Less complicated when it's a non-married spouse because, mm-hmm. again, some of these rules that I talked about that apply to married spouses on property are a little more defined when it comes to married spouses. So. Mm-hmm. But really, the reality is, I mean, are you the owner or you're not? So, you know, who owns the place, right, is one of the questions, right? But there are some entitlements that a spouse has, whether they own it or not, if you're married, right? And so, you know, and there's also the issue of kids. And so, really, you know, you either work it out between yourselves or someone's going to tell you what you're doing.
Right.
And this doesn't happen quickly. And it certainly isn't necessarily a straightforward outcome, right? So, yes, you can go to court and you can ask a judge in a married spouse situation to ask one of the spouses to no longer live there.
Right.
But, you know, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of time, right?
So what
results
do you suggest
are not guaranteed.
In that situation?
You know what? A, you know, have the conversation in advance if you can, right?
But, you know, for sure.
B, you know, you can always get into a negotiation. It doesn't have to be a litigated situation. That tends to go faster anyway, right? And we can talk about, you know, as I said before, you know, those wider range of options. What, you know, are there other things we can do? Can we nest?
Yeah.
Right. So something that I did with my spouse when I separated. You know, I 7 months. You know, my kids lived in the house, and we.
Oh, you guys switched.
We came back and forth. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So
is it a myth or maybe it's the truth? If a spouse leaves the house, do they have any less power or more power in our?
So the broad answer is no.
Hmm.
Right. The rights and obligations
are the same.
Are the same, but you know, as a practical matter, it could have an impact on, you know, do you see the kids?
Right. Right.
You know, is the other spouse? You know, messing around with stuff when you're in, you know, when you're out of the house. So, you know, it may be a more practical consideration than a legal one.
Than the legal
right?
one.
Yeah.
Right. So legally, you might have the same rights, but then the day-to-day matters are a different situation.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, so one of those situations where, oh, hey, listen, I had a case where, you know, my client was out of the house and the husband, you know, drove up with a truck on the weekend,
wow.
you know, packed it all up and left.
Oh my God.
You know, so. You know, and then what do you do?
Right.
Right. So I'm often, you know, when people come to see me, and I know it sounds like it may be sort of conflictual, but it's like, okay, you know, you got to do an inventory. You got to take some pictures. You want to see what the situation was at the time.
Yeah.
So that if something happens, if somebody starts to do stupid things or, you know, gets a little, you know, maybe a little bit unreasonable.
Right.
Right. You've got a record. Okay.
This unfortunately, is emotions are running high and people aren't always thinking straight.
As they do in separations, right?
Right, for sure.
It's right up there with death in terms of the stress it causes people to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I was surprised when we had lunch the other day and you told me that there's a new family law coming out in 2020.
So it's actually the Divorce Act. Yeah. But yes, so we've got changes coming. The bill has passed, the main amendments to the Divorce Act. And they'll take effect next June.
Okay.
And so basically what they've done is, broadly speaking, what they've done is they've said, okay, we're going to stop using these very emotionally charged words like custody and access. We're going to start thinking about parenting. We're going to start thinking about decision making. So we're going to do that. We're going to focus on assisting people in domestic violence or intimate partner violence situations. And we're going to encourage non-adversarial or alternative, what I call consensual dispute resolution processes. And they're going, in fact, they're going to mandate that people are required to consider and to discuss with clients the other the options other than litigation.
And so
that's great.
That's a great segue into what is, so you're going through a separation, you realize it's not working out with your spouse. What are those alternative methods other than going to court in the traditional, like, let's fight kind of situations?
Right. Yeah. So there are several, you know, and it's, I think of it as a range, right? So basically my range, you know, basically goes from sort of negotiating in an informal way together between yourselves, right, all the way to litigation. And somewhere on that range, we have things like mediation, which is a more structured negotiation process with the assistance of a mediator who's a neutral. Collaborative practice is a formal negotiation process, but it's underpinned by an agreement that says we're not going to go to court.
Okay.
We're going to resolve this between ourselves within this process. And they have a contract, and the contract protects them while they have this conversation, puts some safety around the discussions. And the other thing about collaborative is, of course, is we often include other professionals. So we have a financial professional who helps with the finance side and, you know, looks at, you know, what do these proposals look like from a long-term perspective, how do they impact, and also help the spouses find sort of similar ground, you know, so bring some equivalency to the financial information, so everybody's on the same page. And then we have family professionals who handle parenting agreements, who handle the emotional parts, the stuff that the law doesn't really care about, but which really sometimes significantly impacts on people's viewpoints and on what they're looking for and you know what they're prepared to do. And so you know they'll also help us if there are some mental health issues, so managing that, right? So having other professionals. So that's collaborative practice. We also have arbitration, which is essentially private court. What you're doing there is you're hiring a professional who's going to be your decision maker. So you're appointing a judge of your own. You're paying that person. But what you're looking for is you're looking for somebody with expertise that you want, somebody who knows something about the area. You're not just getting some person.
So how does arbitration differ from mediation?
Sorry, so you were asking me about how does arbitration differ from
mediation?
Mediation. So very distinct in that mediation is a voluntary process, and it's the mediator is not a decision maker. They're not going to give advice. Their job is to facilitate the discussion,
okay,
to help people put the information together, talk about, you know, what's on the plate, what do we have to talk about, help them gather information, and then to discuss what are the options and help perhaps draft an agreement. So that's a mediator. Arbitrators are decision makers. They're just like a judge.
Oh, okay.
You're just
half the price.
Yeah. The difference is that, you know, rather than being bound by the requirements that the rules of court have, you can set your own process, obviously with the arbitrator's agreement. And you pick somebody who has the capacity or the skill set that you need for that, you know, for that thing. And then litigation, of course, is a court process. So, you know, and you know what? All of them have their own places, their own benefits. So I would never say one is better or worse. I would say, you know, one might be more appropriate for, you know, certain people than others, right?
I don't hear arbitration. I'm just curious about this because I don't hear it being used a lot, even though I see a lot of family law files come through my desk. I don't see too many arbitrated type files. Why is that? It sounds like it would be a more expeditious process than going to court.
But similar. It can be, yeah. You know, I don't have a good answer for you other than the fact that I think that generally speaking, my profession is not great about talking about those kinds of options in advance. And so often what you're doing is you're finding yourself in court process sort of by default.
Right.
The court process itself does that in the sense that, you know, people, when they, if they go to the courthouse and they're looking for information, you know, they've got to go to a courthouse, number one.
Right.
That's where they find it. Number two, they have these mandatory information sessions that are available. Hmm. They're at the courthouse. They're done by court staff. Yeah. Right. And yes, they talk about other processes. But once you're in the court,
sort of a freight train starts going.
Yeah, exactly. So it's hard to. So I really, you know, I'm hoping that these changes to the Divorce Act we were talking about are going to change that approach somewhat for people, and that we're going to start talk about some alternatives
for
the court process and, you know, much earlier.
Absolutely.
The other thing we'll do, I hope, is, you know, and I'm working on this as well, is having some discussions in the community, you know, so making information available publicly. Right. To allow people to know about this stuff before they get in.
Right.
Right.
So, for sure.
Yeah.
So if a spouse is thinking, you know, things aren't going well and they're feeling that, you know, their marriage is going to end, or their cohabitation or whatever the relationship is, what are the steps they should take? How do they start this process? What do they do? Who should they, and what's step one?
Well, if they're going to come and see me, you know, then I'm going to encourage them to come and talk to me, have a consultation.
Yeah.
And I offer a free half-hour consultation, and so we talk only about process.
Perfect.
And I, you know, I'll talk to them about those options, right? But if they're coming in through another source, say through a mortgage broker, because they're saying, "Hey, what do I do with my house?" Or they're coming in because, you know, someone's getting their hair cut, and they're talking to the barber or the hairdresser and saying, "Oh God, you know, what am I doing?" Right? What I want to do is I want to encourage those people, those potential referral sources to me, to know about these alternatives, so they can say, "Hey, you know what? You need to talk to this guy or to this person, this woman about these options."
Right, because not everything has to be a high conflict situation, right?
100%. You know, look, almost all cases settle out of court.
Right.
Very, very few. Like, we're talking 3-4%.
Yeah.
You know, actually get resolved through a trial at the end, right? And those are only the ones that get started in a court process. There's a whole bunch of other cases that never see, you know, anything near a court. Yeah. Right. And so the vast majority of conflicts, family conflicts, are resolved outside of the court process. Yeah. So it's kind of funny that we, you know, that the whole thing is directed at, you know,
at
getting,
that,
you know, getting to a court process. You know, I'm really, you know, recently talking to the parliamentary secretary for the attorney general now, and saying, you know, why are we putting all this resource into, you know, this system that is used by so, at the end of the day, ends up being used by so few people.
Right.
Right. Why aren't we having some initial consultation, some opportunity for people to talk about this stuff before they get into a process.
Help ratchet down the conflict, not ratchet it up.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
See, I was really lucky when I grew up. My mom and dad split up when I was just a wee little guy, and they managed to work it through that they actually worked together in their business still for years. So I grew up having mom and dad, and, you know, mom and stepdad, and dad and stepmom, and we'd have Christmases together. And
that's great.
Yeah. People always thought that's so bizarre. And that's been my upbringing. So I'm like, even though you have conflict and you go through life and things happen, it doesn't mean it has to blow up.
So, you know, Chad, that's not a typical outcome, right? Much more often we see, conflict, particularly with new partners and with new families, right? And so, if we can help people learn to communicate better, if we can help people, with processes that are not as damaging as, a litigation or an adversarial process can be, that's, I think, going to result in fewer of the situations 100%. That are so common now, right?
100%. So let's jump into collaborative law. I tell my clients it's kind of divorced the nice way. and how did it start? What's the history of it? Where did it come from?
So there was a guy in Minnesota by the name of Stu Webb, a lawyer. Hmm. And, like many of us who do this stuff, he was disenchanted. Hmm. He realized how destructive courts could, court processes could be to families.
Right.
And so he was looking for a different way. And so he, but he needed people to play with, if I can say that, right? He had to, you can't do this on your own.
Right.
Right. We have conflict rules. We, we can't be representing two sides. That's just, that doesn't work well. So he basically had to convince some other people in his area, and so it grew up in his area, and then it expanded into the U.S. and then into Canada. Excuse me. And then, you know, like I said, in about 2001, 2002, it came to Ottawa.
Right.
And so we had a little group of people, probably about 25, 28, you know, people who said, yeah, let's do this, you know, differently. And by that time, there was, you know, there was, a, I guess, a cohort who could come and train and, you know, talk about what the process looks like. And even then, it's developed.
Right.
You know, it started off what I call the classic model was, you know, two lawyers and two parties. And if you needed help with a parenting plan, maybe you, you know, you brought a, you know, a therapist in or a mental health professional in. Now the it's much more of a team approach, so we're including within the process the financial and the what we call family professional, so
yeah.
Social worker, or a therapist, or, you know, a psychiatrist, or a psychologist, something like that, right? Who are going to help people with those, say, with those emotional parts. And the idea is that the professional with the appropriate skills does the part that, you know.
Right. So a person specialized in family, you know, family planning would, or access would create an access plan.
Right. But more like, so I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, the legal parts the lawyers do.
Right.
You know, the emotional and parenting stuff is done by the family professional, and the financial stuff, you know, gathering information, you know,
right.
Doing projections, doing calculations, that's done by the financial. So have the correct professional doing the correct work, right?
That, absolutely.
That's kind of what we, that's the idea. And it worked great. You know, when it works well, it really works well. It's such a nice way to, you know, to help families.
All right. So how does this, somebody start? If they're interested in, if they hear about this, they're planning, you know, yes, we're done to lead separation, you know, and they hear, okay, collaborative, what's the first step? Who do they, obviously they can reach out to you for sure.
They can come to a lawyer. They can go to one of the financial professionals. There's a website for Ottawa called Collaborative Practice Ottawa.
Okay, that's great.
Right, .ca. There's an international website, International Association of Collaborative
Professionals.
Yeah. And it's a .com, IACP.com. Mm-hmm. The OACP.co is the provincial organization. There's a website with that. You know, so lots of places to get information. And in each case, there's a list of collaborative professionals in the area.
Because not all lawyers are part of it, although they,
right.
I think they all should be.
Yes.
But so you can go to the website, find some professionals in your area.
Find a professional in your area, right? And collaborative, the Ontario Association of Collaborative Professionals site, for example, you know, it shows you where each of the groups in the province is.
Yeah.
You go on there and there's a list, right? And of course, the other thing is, you know, talk to your, you know, friends who've been through it.
Yeah.
You know, there's some really good stuff on the website, on the AG's website, both AG, main Attorney General, both Canada and Ontario. So yeah, lots of stuff.
So there's a few key differences about the collaborative process that is very, very different.
Yes.
One of them being that you guys have to agree not to go to court.
Correct. So we actually sign an agreement that says that. So, and the underpinning is the withdrawal provision that basically says, you know what, if you want to get out of this process, right, then the process fails. Now there is an exception. You could change lawyers and stay in the process as long as you get another collaborative lawyer and everybody agrees. But, you know, there's a significant downside after going through the work to, you know, get disclosure together, figure out what you're, you know, going to be discussing and arguing about, you know, and starting negotiation. There's a significant downside then to getting out of the process. So that's, you know, that's a definite difference.
Absolutely. And is it typically cost less money going through collaborative versus traditional routes?
So I hesitate to say that collaborative is less expensive or more expensive. What I say instead is my experience is that we can be far more efficient, and we can manage conflict better. And so the chances are that it's going to be a less expensive process. It is going to be more expensive than, say, you know, informal negotiations.
Right.
You know, and sometimes it might a single mediator talking might be a less expensive process if things are relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
So it really does come down to cost is all about conflict and complication.
Right.
Right. And it doesn't matter what process you're in. If you're conflictual and if your situation is complicated, it's going to cost you more.
Right.
Right. But my, experience is that if we can do this through the collaborative process in an efficient way, right,
it works better.
It tends to be more cost effective.
Yeah.
And by far less expensive than your standard litigation process. Yeah. But I can't promise you that.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Every situation is unique. But I've also anecdotally noticed the in those higher conflict situations that you can't just solve between, you know, two people and a mediator like that says, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. The agreements tend to be a little bit more sustainable.
Yes. Well, and that's one of the things we know that we talk about is that a negotiated agreement typically gets better buy-in than something that's imposed on people. So that's point number one.
Yeah.
Point number two is if you're engaged in the discussion about why we're doing it this way, and if you're getting feedback about why this works or doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
right, you're going to be far, I think, more comfortable accepting, right?
Absolutely.
Like, you know, we don't know what we don't know, right? And so if a parent comes in and says, you know, hey, I want 50-50 time, which is we often get, right? And so in a collaborative process, we want to get underneath that. We want to say, okay, so tell me about that. Why, what does that mean to you? What does that look like? And why is it? Why is 50-50 important?
Right.
And so we can get away from focusing on the outcome,
right,
which is the position, and start focusing on interests, which is what's the underlying issue here? What's the problem? What's the concern?
Yeah.
You know, what's the fear? Whatever it is, right? Yeah. Then we can start to look at solutions that address those,
right,
as opposed to simply, you know, saying, oh, well, in my case, you know, I'll do week on, week off. Well, you know, if you're a, you know, if you're a, you know, somebody's working shifts, you know, or, you know, somebody's got, you know, works long hours or travels a lot, you know, maybe that's not the right answer.
Right.
Right. And so let's talk about what that looks like and how does it
plan real life.
Yeah. And what's the effect on the children, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Absolutely.
Hmm. So we look, you know, so that's another great benefit of the collaborative process is that we're interest based.
Mm-hmm.
We're focused on what's, you know, what's underneath.
Perfect.
Right. It's private.
Yeah.
That's another thing. So courts are not,
right?
So if you want to maintain, you know, some level of
privacy
about your situation, collaborative is a great process. The other thing that is, I think, is a real benefit is the fact that it's really a safe and secure process.
Yeah.
It can be designed to meet the situation. So, you know, if there's somebody who has a mental health issue, bipolar, for example, right? We can design our process to account for that, right? And we have the supports because we have the mental health professional who's participating with us, right? So we know a little bit about what's going on. And I guess one of the best examples for me of a successful team, I had a client who was bipolar, and he knew he was bipolar, right? And so, you know, I said, look, I think collaborative process is the right answer here. So we had a mental health professional, what we call a family relations professional in our parlance, right, who, you know, spoke to him, spoke to the wife, came back to us with information about, okay, so look, these are the things we have to be aware of. These are the concerns, right? So we managed our process, having an understanding about the manifestation of that condition,
right?
And when the chips were down and we were, you know, we were getting to a tough spot, right? They were able to talk to the mental health professional in real time, right? And we solved it and it was resolved,
right?
It was like fantastic. Contrasted with a situation where, you know, we were in a four-way negotiation, lawyers and parties, and, you know, the husband in that case was very, very, had been convinced that his, you know, wife had an affair.
Yeah.
She denied it. I don't think there was anything to suggest that it was legit, but he had this fear. And so when we got to talking about, you know, what to do about the kids, I can't talk about this. He was so wound up and we had to stop that meeting.
Right.
We had to suggest to him that he go talk to somebody, right? There was a big delay. There was all kinds of conflict. It was, like, you know. So the difference was being able to deal with that stuff head on, know about it in advance, and deal with the fallout as it arose.
Right.
That was fantastic. It worked well.
Yeah. Well, Jim, that's fantastic. I really, really appreciate it. And as you know, I've been a fan of collaborative law, the process for a long time. And I encourage everybody, if they're going through separation, to look into it, research it, go to the websites, and reach out to professionals like yourself and use that first.
Yeah, you can find me at jjeffcott@lmrlawyers.com. That's my email. Yeah. Our website is lmrlawyers.com. Mm-hmm. You can find us there. Or, as I told you about before, the collaborative website, Ottawa, Ontario, or international.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks, Chad.
Great.